Welcome into the program. Thank you for being with us on this Tuesday. Now, I could have come back on Monday, but I had a Bible class to teach, which, by the way, the brothers and sisters up at the Midway Church of Christ in Huntsville, which were just absolutely great to be able to visit with them this weekend. They were nice enough to let me teach one of their Bible classes, which, by the way, I will be pulling and cutting a version of to have available on the Tactics YouTube channel. And if you haven't looked at that yet, you really do need to check it out. It's not only got some great bonus stuff, like some of my sermons, but also you're going to get all the content right here. We display it a day later. We take out all the breaks, just make it a little bit smoother, do a little editing. And we also have individual segments at youtube.com/tacticsradio. And if you want to check that out, maybe you just want to watch a couple of chaplain's reports. Maybe you just need a little bit of encouragement from God's Word, and that's just really what you need. Go there. Go to our playlist, chaplain's reports. You'll have a big list of them, but it's just chaplain's reports. You'll also see stuff for Daily Dose of Stupid. So lots of great content. Be sure to check that out. And don't forget, you can call us to talk about what is on your mind. 860-1440. We still have the phone lines available, just like in the old radio days. And we also, of course, have it to where you can tweet us at Tactics Radio on Twitter. So there's a myriad of ways to get in touch with us, and we are really striving to, especially after the beginning of this year, really, really working towards trying to get you more involved in the program, to get more caller interaction, more viewer interaction, that kind of thing. So if you want to leave a comment on Twitter, you want to leave a comment on Facebook, you are certainly welcome to do so, and we always are glad to have that, to have you with us. Now, that being said, we have a lot of material to get to today, and that is partially because yesterday I wound up taking the day off. I was up in Huntsville, and we see that there has been an unfortunate, disturbing turn in the Supreme Court. Now, I'm not going to be the I told you so guy, because I don't think it's productive. But, and frankly, I don't even remember that many people disagreeing with me, to be perfectly honest. And so it wouldn't do much good to go the I told you so route. But unfortunately, it seems as though there was a lawsuit the other day specifically pertaining to abortion, and you had Justices Kavanaugh and Roberts siding with the liberals. And this is just based on insiders that I know that have been around the court, that know how these things go, that understand the politics of the court, and a lot of them very, very smart constitutionalist lawyers. They said that there's been a disturbing trend recently of both Kavanaugh and Roberts seeming to rush more towards the left, and they're predicting that part of that is because both of them kind of want to be the new Roberts, which to a degree I don't agree with, but I understand, because Roberts was the swing vote, and because Roberts was the swing vote, because he was ideologically sort of in the middle and would occasionally side with the left and occasionally side with the right, well, he actually became the most powerful justice. Not the Chief Justice, Justice Roberts. But in a lot of ways, Kennedy was the most powerful justice because both the dissents and the opinions were more influenced by him than anybody else. Because the judges would, you know, I guess moderate their language to sort of suit him. And they would come to more narrow decisions based on what Kennedy wanted, because they were trying to curry Kennedy's vote. They wanted him to be on their side. And so because of that, we got a lot of moderate sort of mealy-mouthed, middle-of-the-road opinions, because they were catering to Justice Kennedy's sensibilities. And unfortunately, what we're seeing now is that it seems as though both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh seem to be trying to fill that void and doing so at the same time. And so it seems as though we are back to having sort of a 4-2-3 on the court. So four liberals, two kind of moderates, and three justices. And we'll get into some of the specifics of that. Before we do that, though, I want to point out a side note. Part of my reporting comes from an article in Politico. And I just want to point out some of Politico's bias is on full display in this thing. And this is not coming from a main news outlet like Politico. This really shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody. But they constantly, instead of referring to pro-choice, now the words pro-choice are in there, but only when they are quoting the Susan B. Anthony list, which is a pro-choice group. Pro-life. The word pro-life never appears in the article. I'm sorry, I messed that up. I got that completely backwards. The words pro-life never show up. Pro-choice appears quite a few times, but you'll notice that when the left tends to talk about people that are for abortion, they refer to them as pro-choice. When they talk about people that are against abortion, they refer to them as anti-abortion. I don't know how many times I saw the words anti-abortion in this particular article. And then when they talk about the people that are pro-choice, they'll usually not only say pro-choice, but they'll say they're pro-healthcare and pro-liberty and that kind of thing. That's not true, but anyway, their bias is really on full display there. Politico, who purports to be an impartial, objective journalist group, they are referring to, in their article, pro-life people as anti-abortion and pro-choice people as being for healthcare decisions. Things like that. Here's a little sample of it. This is from Politico. For decades, no federal dollars have gone to fund abortions, but there have been many legal battles over whether providers like Planned Parenthood that offer a wide range of health services. And they go on to say if they offer a wide range of health services. So here you have Politico sort of in a backhanded way making the case for why Planned Parenthood should not be defunded. They said, for decades, no federal dollars have gone to fund abortions. Well, again, that's not true. Because if it's going to a place that provides abortions, you are helping provide abortions. That would be like me saying that I was giving to any kind of charitable organization that does X, Y, and Z and say, well, I'm only funding X. Well, if you're only funding X, then how do you know that you're not freeing up other capital that they would have had to spend on X to do Y and Z? And so that's the thing. Like, for example, if I go into a restaurant and I purchase you a hamburger, that's pretty clear cut. I bought you a hamburger. But if I give you $10 and you had $10 in your pocket and you were going to use your money to buy that hamburger, but I said, here, I want you to take this $10, but I don't want you to spend it on this hamburger. But if you were going to have to spend it on that hamburger, if I hadn't given you the $10, or sorry, if you're going to have to spend it on something other than the hamburger, if I had not given you that $10, then that frees up your $10 to buy that hamburger. And I'm just using hamburgers as an arbitrary product here, of course. But the point is, if you are giving money to that organization and we give $500 million to Planned Parenthood every single year, I mean, $500 million is a lot of money. I think the actual figure is like $490 million, but still, I mean, that's a ridiculous sum of money. And the fact that we are continuing to do this and saying, well, we're not funding abortions, well, if you're looking at abortions being a large portion of what they're doing, and you look at that being their primary source of revenue, then by us giving them federal grants and federal money through Medicaid or whatever else, we are in effect funding abortions because we're giving them money to spend on these services that are not abortion, but that also frees up other money that they would have used on it to spend more money on abortion. So while you may not use technically the same $10 bill that I gave you, it still freed up the capital to allow you to spend your own $10 on whatever it was that you wanted. And so this is the thing, this is the hat trick, the hat game they try to play with you where they shuffle everything around. It's the same pile of money. And because they are able to spend less of their money on the other services, the ones that we're talking about, they get to spend more money on abortion, and so in effect, we are funding abortions. So again, this is part of the game that they play in Politico providing cover for Planned Parenthood and then also talking about how they offer a wide range of health services. They really don't. There are things that are not abortion that Planned Parenthood does, but if you're looking at the vast majority of their business and what they actually try to promote people to do, they're an abortion mill. I mean, that would be like me saying, well, Major League Baseball, the Atlanta Braves. The Atlanta Braves are not a baseball team because they sell way more hot dogs than they do tickets. They sell way more hot dogs than they play games. Ergo, they're really more of a hot dog company. Well, no, that's stupid. The Braves, the reason you're buying those hot dogs are because you go there to get a baseball game. Now you sell more hot dogs, you sell more Cokes and all that other stuff, and that's actually where the team makes a lot of its money. But the point is, you are an entertainment venue that runs baseball games, and that's the draw, and that's the primary thing that you do. Just because you sell more of one product does not mean that you're doing less business in that one. And so when people try to use these scams and say, well, you know, abortion does all these other things. Yes, they do. But they also, their primary draw is abortion. And I think that there is an easy solution to this. If Planned Parenthood is so concerned about the health care of women and they want to continue getting these federal dollars, it's very simple. Stop doing abortions. Then I will not complain about Planned Parenthood. Well, actually, I will complain about Planned Parenthood getting that money, but not because it's them. I would complain about it because I'm a libertarian. But my point in all of that is, if you at least did that, then your federal dollars wouldn't be going to fund abortions, at least. So because of this, let's just do a little bit of background so we can set the table here. We all know about the efforts recently to defund Planned Parenthood, and those are mostly done at the state level. And the reason that it was mostly done at the state level is because, let's be honest, the Republicans in Washington are just completely worthless. I mean, we had a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican president, and nobody thought to, in all of the budget arguments that we've had, nobody thought to defund Planned Parenthood. I mean, there were efforts in the House and the Senate to do so at one point, but the Republicans were like, yeah, we don't want to do that. Even though they control the House and the Senate and the presidency, somehow you have not taken a dime away from Planned Parenthood. And to me, that would be non-negotiable. That would be number one right there. Say, if I were the Speaker of the House or in charge of the Ways and Means, it's like, look, Planned Parenthood funding, that's gone. We can discuss other things. We can have a debate about that. But Planned Parenthood, they're not getting any more federal dollars. Just not going to happen. That is heretofore gone. And the idea that the Republicans in Washington are just continuing to basically sit idle, most of them, the vast majority of them, while Planned Parenthood is funding abortions with taxpayer dollars, is just absolutely sickening. And because of this, a lot more fights have been happening to defund Planned Parenthood on the state level. For example, there are some people that are really upset now that states like Kansas and Louisiana have tried to block Medicaid spending from going to Planned Parenthood, because those tend to be slightly more red states, and so because of that, even though Louisiana certainly has its blue districts, it tends to be mostly red, and the same could be said for Kansas. And so because of that, they have tried to defund Planned Parenthood on the state level, which, by the way, several states have done to great success. For example, the state of Texas, they moved to block Planned Parenthood. And no more dollars going to them. Guess what happened? All the left, they were freaking out because what we're going to have is we're going to have all these unwanted teen pregnancies. You know what actually happened? Teen pregnancy went down. Teen births went down. Turns out that when you actually, you know, hold people accountable for their actions, they tend to act more responsibly. And so if you're looking at that and you understand that this actually has a societal benefit to it, regardless of what you feel about Planned Parenthood or whether abortion should be right or not, most of us agree that by and large abortion is a bad thing, even if you think that it should be. Now, there are some crazy people that actually don't believe that. Cecile Richards, the whole shout your abortion thing. There are exceptions to that. But by and large, you ask the average person on the left, even though they want abortion to be kept legal, they'll say that they don't agree with it being done in practice, or they think that it should be at least done less. But here we actually see a glaring example of states like Texas and Louisiana trying to block Medicaid spending from going to Planned Parenthood. And because of that, several cases have been brought up. And there have actually been, I think, two similar abortion cases earlier this year. Now, to be frank and to be completely clear with this, the question on the table right now is not, should abortion be banned? I guess theoretically, maybe there's a way the court could have potentially gotten there had they taken this case, but that's not the question that's being asked right now. What's being asked right now is, does a person who wants to seek health care at a Planned Parenthood clinic, even though it's not an abortion, do they have the right to sue their state for banning funding and Medicaid dollars from going to Planned Parenthood. And in this lower court decision, they decided that the answer is no. Now, there are other conflicting court decisions from other districts and other jurisdictions that say yes. And so what you've got is, depending on what district you happen to be in the United States, which circuit court you are under, that is going to determine whether or not you have the ability to sue your state for, I guess, saying that you have to go to a service provider that does not provide abortions. And so that's the issue on the table. So regardless of which way this particular case went, it's very, very, very unlikely that it would have done anything to overturn Roe v. Wade. All this would have done is say, this is primarily, and this is what Justice Thomas wrote in his dissent, the question on the table has very little to do with abortion. It's at best tangentially attached to abortion. And so what the real question here is, it's about the relationship between the individual citizen, the state, and the federal government. It's really a federalism case, which is also a reason why I believe it's a shame that they chose to not actually hear it. And Justice Roberts and Kavanaugh both sided with the liberal justices to side with them against hearing this case from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And unfortunately, this means that the lower court's rulings are going to remain in place. And not just this one, but the others as well. And the primary reason that I think that this is a problem is something that Justice Thomas actually brought up. He said, quote, "Because of the court's inaction, patients in different states, even patients with the same providers, have different rights to challenge their state's provider decision." And he's exactly right on that. The big problem with allowing this case to stand is not so much that it's this case in a vacuum that is the problem. Because normally what you have is, and this is how the law works, when it gets appealed and they try to have it heard by the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court says no, that's precedent stands. Whatever the lower court ruled, that's the one that remains in place. The only problem with that in this particular situation is very similar cases have arose asking exactly the same question, and depending on what circuit court you happen to be in, different courts have found different answers. And so it seems to me, and it seems to also to Justice Thomas, that it was imperative that they actually do resolve this problem so that there's not conflicting rulings in the lower courts. And so it really is astounding that the court decided not to hear this, and I don't understand what the justification by Roberts and Kavanaugh could be. Justice Thomas also wrote, "Some tenuous connection to a politically fraught issue does not justify abdicating our judicial duty. If anything, neutrally applying the law is all the more important when political issues are in the background." And Justice Thomas, of course, is exactly right yet again. He's saying that it's important that we resolve this specifically because there is politics connected to it. See, I think that basically what this is hinting at, and Justice Thomas knows much more about this than I do, not just from a legal perspective, but from knowing Justice Roberts. Justice Roberts has this real unfortunate tendency to not want to do big things. He wants to be mild, he wants to be under the radar, he wants to not cause waves and not stir the pot. And to a degree, as a justice, I get that to some extent, unless you're talking about a matter where somebody's gotten it wrong, unless you're talking a matter about the law. If you are going to take up a case, and granted, this was one case where they decided not to take the case, but if you are going to take up a case, you need to paint in broad colors, and you need to be very clear and very specific so that the lower courts understand where they're supposed to go. And unfortunately, under Roberts, the court has a bad habit of constantly giving sort of middle-of-the-road, narrow victories to one side or the other. Whether I agree with the opinion or not, they're doing so on very, very narrow legal ground. And because of that, you have to have other cases that come up before the Supreme Court. And so I don't understand why Roberts has this judicial philosophy. If anything, you ought to be very clear and very concise and very specific when making your rulings and saying, answering the bigger question in sort of a minor question. And unfortunately, Roberts seems to have a tendency to not want to cause any kind of controversy, and because of that, he avoids conflict and does not take cases that he believes will be controversial, and I think this is sort of indicative of that. But here's the bottom line. If Kavanaugh really wanted to take a jab at abortion, if he was really this pro-life advocate that we've been hearing that he was for forever, here was his chance. Here was his chance. He had a shot to take, and he chose not to take it. Now, do I necessarily think that or believe that this means that Brett Kavanaugh is pro-choice? No. This doesn't necessarily mean that. I've heard a couple of different theories on this that I think are at least plausible. My good friend Matt Clark over at the Foundation for Moral Law, he proposed this particular interpretation of it. He said what may be happening, because there are other cases that more directly involve abortion a little bit down the road, what may be happening is that Kavanaugh and Justice Roberts are sort of saving this kind of political ammo until a case comes forward that they can actually use it to overturn Roe v. Wade. I doubt that very seriously, and I appreciate Matt's optimism. I think he's wrong on that. I really hope that he's right and I'm wrong. I'd much rather that be the scenario. But I think that it's a little bit too much wishful thinking. Now, again, this decision does not necessitate that Brett Kavanaugh is pro-choice, and I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that if given the opportunity, he wouldn't overturn Roe v. Wade, because I don't know that. I don't know what's in the man's heart. But when we're looking at his record, like I said, before he was confirmed, as soon as he was named, actually before he was even named the nominee, back when Trump had whittled it down to about five people, I said then, his record is just not that great when it comes to abortion. It's not bad, it's just kind of non-existent. He doesn't really bring up abortion very often. And it was actually kind of humorous that this was the best case scenario for Democrats. The Democrats, who made this big stink and tried to get the man convicted as a gang rapist of all things, and did this whole media circus where they tried to keep him from getting confirmed, they couldn't have asked for a better candidate from a Republican president. And I think, unfortunately, this leads to the idea, this is a really bad omen. It was like I was saying just the other day. You know, if you look off into the distance and see a giant column of smoke coming from your house, it doesn't necessarily mean your house is on fire. There are other explanations for why that smoke is coming from that direction, but that doesn't mean you're not justified in being very concerned that your house might be on fire, and it doesn't mean you don't need to rush home and see what's happening and to see if everything's okay. And so, again, while this doesn't necessarily mean that Kavanaugh is going to be somebody that's at best a swing vote, at worst, somebody that tends to side with the liberal justices when it comes to abortion, I don't know that that's necessarily the case based on this opinion, but it's not looking good. This is a really, really bad sign. And this is what I warn people about. What they did to Kavanaugh was beyond despicable. The way that they tried to ruin the guy's life, ruin his reputation, and end his legal career because they had a political disagreement with the guy or they were worried about him made no sense. And it was morally reprehensible. So I'm not in any way trying to justify what the Democrats did. But the irony in all of that is that the Democrats, probably out of all the candidates that was on Trump's shortlist, he would have been the guy that they should have been most pleased about, maybe with the exception of Thomas Hardiman. And so I didn't understand that circus, because I'm like, the guy's not even really super conservative. You don't even know for a fact that he would overturn Roe v. Wade if given the opportunity. And based on his record, it didn't seem like he was really super zealous about that. And granted, part of it was because we just don't see that many abortion cases show up in the D.C. Circuit Court, but still. And so, really, it was much ado about nothing, and I think, unfortunately, this proves that I wish that I was wrong on that. I wish that the Democrats were actually right and they had to worry quite a bit about the overturning of Roe v. Wade, but at this point, it does not look like that's something that they have to worry themselves over anytime soon. And all signs right now show that Roberts definitely wants to be the new Kennedy, and Kavanaugh may sort of be falling into that mold, which shouldn't surprise us because he knew Kennedy well and was the guy that replaced him. So, I'm afraid, unfortunately, I hope I'm wrong on this, but the signs are pointing to we may have another 4-2-3 court. Four liberals, two moderates, three conservatives. I was really hopeful for the new Supreme Court, but I'm just telling you, right now, it's not looking good. There's another story, local story that we have, of a Montgomery Public School teacher named Candace McCray, 37, who she is a teacher at Brubaker Middle School, and apparently she still has her job, is still there, but she is alleged to having, it is alleged that she was having intercourse with one of her students, which is problematic for a number of reasons, but right now, I mean, it is just, I don't understand this. And I don't know if this is going to be taken in the way in which it is intended, but I don't understand, especially a female teacher of all things, being involved with a male student. Because even though it's morally just disgusting, regardless of which way that it goes, if it's a male teacher with a female student, it's still just as wrong. It's no better just because the roles are flipped when it comes to gender. That doesn't make it any better. It's still morally wrong. In fact, I think you could even kind of make the moral argument that when it's the opposite, when it's an older man with a younger girl, that it may even be more wrong. But it's still a sin. It's still evil. There's no other way to put it. But at least with that, I kind of understand it. You know, just because something's evil doesn't mean you can't understand it. And so I kind of get it, because men, by our very nature, are very visual creatures. We tend to be far more concerned with a woman's looks and appearance and a youthfulness than women are with men. I mean, women can be attracted to older gentlemen, for example. I don't know how many women I've heard talk about how attractive they find guys like George Clooney or Sean Connery. Another great example, you know, older guys that women find very appealing. And part of the reason for this is because they tend to care more about wisdom and usefulness, those kind of things. And so because of that, they're really less visually driven than we are. But see, to a guy, seeing a very attractive, firm body of a teenager, I can kind of understand why the guy is at least attracted to her. Doesn't justify his action. Doesn't justify, you know, pursuing her or flirting with her, any of that. I'm just saying, at least I understand it from that perspective. I don't understand why a woman who is college educated, because if she's a teacher, she has to have a college education, a college educated woman with a job that can obviously provide for herself, why on earth would an adult woman want to go after and get involved with a teenage boy? That I just do not get. First of all, what's going on in Europe now is of great concern to me. And it really should be of great concern to you. Because it was one thing when the protests were going on in France. But now they've spread across UK, Belgium, Netherlands. Thousands of people, thousands, are going out and protesting. And we've had hundreds and hundreds of arrests. And there are, I think, 90,000 law enforcement officers that were deployed to try to handle all the protests and riots. And I mean, you're looking at this stuff. Paris right now looks, at least in some parts, I don't know if this is indicative of the way the whole city looks, but Paris looks like a war zone. And there were protesters in cities all across France protesting, and in these other countries as well, setting cars on fire, smashing windows, ransacking businesses. And I don't understand that. Does anybody in that crowd really believe that, oh, if I smash in this storefront window, people will listen to me? People that use their emotions to make decisions are just not in a good place. And when you use your anger and rage and hatred to attack innocent people that have nothing to do with the problem you're dealing with, whether the problem is true or imagined, and I think that there are some legitimate complaints about the people of France, I just don't understand why this is the method that you use to express yourself. There's a difference in protesting, which is a human right, the right to assembly, and going out and breaking laws. And this is exactly the same thing that was going on, I mean, for completely different reasons, obviously, and not nearly to the scale that it is in Europe. But this is what was going on in Birmingham, and it's just as wrong there as it is in Europe. These are a bunch of immature children that don't know how to handle their problems, and because of that, they're acting out and throwing a temper tantrum. It's no different here than it was in Birmingham. If you're going to protest, even if I disagree with your protest, I will stand for your right to assemble. I will stand for your right to go out and protest. When you start breaking laws and try to use the veil, as it were, of law to protect you, then we have to have a very different conversation. When you're going out and protesting and smashing in a storefront and saying, well, this is my right to free speech. No. That does not give you authorization to attack the life, liberty, or property of another human being. That's not how this works. And unfortunately, this is what's going on in Europe right now. And this kind of protesting obviously is never okay. But France really does look like when the Nazis came through almost. I mean, you're looking at old historic pictures of World War II and what happened after Germany. And it's not really looking all that much different with the broken buildings and the broken storefronts and people being cleared off the street. It kind of looks the same. I'm not saying it's exactly the same, and I'm not calling these protesters Nazis. I'm just saying there is a similarity between the state of the city when the Germans invaded and what's going on now. So I don't want people to take that out of context. I'm not calling these protesters Nazis. There may be some in there. I don't know. I have no reason to believe that. I'm just saying that the tactics being employed here are leaving the city in a similar state. So what's keeping these protests going? Because, you know, we've talked about it, no telling how many times. We've talked about some of the issues that are going on in there. We've talked about the gas tax, which was sort of the spark that lit this. Look, the gas tax is just the straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's a contributing factor for sure. But it is not the underlying reason for all of the protests. And the reason that I know that is, Macron already announced that they would not be doing the gas tax. They already pulled that off the table, and they're still protesting. So, sure, in France, the gas tax may have been what sparked the fire. It's the fuse that got lit. But it is by no means the problem, the source of all the problems. And we just looked at three other countries that we were bringing up, Belgium, Netherlands, and the UK. They didn't have the gas tax, yet they're all protesting just like France is. Now, they did it in response to France to a great degree, but they've got their own problems in their own country, and that's the reason that they are protesting now. And this is sweeping across Europe. And if Europe becomes truly destabilized and it winds up really cutting into their economy, really cutting into their productivity, and makes them less safe, this is not good for us. Especially when you consider what is going on in Ukraine right now. Russia has gotten super bold over the past couple of years. And this past couple of weeks, we talked about the story where they were taking people captive in the Ukraine, taking Ukrainian Navy officers captive. And they've already taken Crimea. And virtually nobody has done anything about it. So this is the thing. If you were Vladimir Putin, what would be your ideal scenario? For Europe to be so self-absorbed and so concerned with what they're doing that they're not really paying attention to what you're doing. And for America to be the same way, to be so absorbed in our own politics and what's going on here at home that we're not really all that worried about our common enemy, Russia. And so if you are Vladimir Putin, this is the ideal scenario that I want to be operating in right now. And we've got to be very careful not to take our eye off the ball, because I believe, and maybe I'm wrong, and I hope that I am, I believe that what's going on right now is something that Vladimir Putin is going to try to capitalize on. And maybe nothing happens, maybe I'm worried over nothing, but this is the problem with socialism. It is a destabilizing force by its nature. Because if you're looking at, I was looking at an interview with one of the protesters just the other day, and one of their reasons for the protest, again, wasn't the gas tax. That probably contributed to it, but one of the things that she was saying in her interview is, I'm paying taxes and my children are paying taxes, and yet my children are not going to have the same benefits that I did when I was coming through. And when you're talking about benefits, you're talking about, you know, free college, free higher education, all that other stuff. So we're seeing this play out exactly the same way that it played out in Greece a few years ago. See, that was the thing, and I said it at the time about Greece. Greece is just going through this early. All of this stuff is going to happen in Europe, and now it is. And why is it happening? For exactly the same thing that people and conservatives like myself have been saying for years. The problem with socialism is eventually you run out of people's money. It's the way that it always takes place. And when people don't get those benefits that they're used to, that they've come to depend on, that they believe in their head is a right and something that they're entitled to, and they're paying the same amount, actually more in taxes than they used to, and not getting the same benefits because you've taxed wealth, you've taxed success out of business, then eventually what you do wind up with is the state that you've got now, to where you're taxing regular people through the nose, but you still don't have enough money to cover all the benefits and fulfill all your promises. And believe it or not, this is going to happen in the U.S. if we don't reverse course pretty quickly. I mean, we're already seeing Social Security is basically just a safe full of IOUs. And we're having to use the regular budget to pay for Social Security because we've got, right now, last time I saw the statistic, we have 5 people on Social Security for every 1 worker. Well, that's not sustainable. Anybody that can do basic math can understand that. And we keep trying to add more social programs. We keep trying to add more things that our government is required to pay for. And it is not going to work. And we're going to have to keep requiring more taxes to keep paying for it, and eventually you are going to run out of other people's money. That's exactly what Margaret Thatcher predicted in the UK, that eventually you're going to run out of people's money, and then the people are going to be mad. The people are going to be angry because they've been accustomed to getting these things, and now they're not. And that's what happened in Greece. Greece was a protest largely because of government programs running out and pensions that were promised to government employees not being fulfilled. You cannot continue to have a huge centralized government like that that requires all of those resources, that has all that waste and bureaucracy, and you eventually run out of resources and people get mad that they don't get their stuff. That's the problem with socialism in a nutshell. Right now, Europe has $240 trillion in debt combined. $240 trillion. To give you an idea of how ridiculous that is, if you put together the entire world's GDP, the entire world's GDP, that's everything that is made from rubber bands in a rubber band factory to a fancy sports car. Every dime of value that is created in this world in a year comes up to a little under 50 trillion. So you're talking about a debt that currently equals, just in Europe, these are just European countries, Europe's debt by itself is roughly 5 times what the entire world makes in 1 year. You don't see how that's not sustainable. You don't see why these countries are saying, look, we're not going to be able to give these benefits to you anymore. We're out of money. The piggy bank's dry. That's why government does not need to be the one that is allocating these resources, because A, people become entitled, they start expecting it, and they think that you're denying them something that they are owed if you don't give it to them. And second, and I think this may be the more important one, is that eventually you've taxed people to death and have nothing to show for it. You've taxed people through the nose because government, by its very nature, is just really bad at managing this kind of stuff. Then you've taken out all these taxes and you still don't have the services that were being promised. You pay a lot and get nothing. That's why it's better to treat things as commodities as opposed to actual rights. So, that being said, we're going to go ahead and skip to the Daily Dose of Stupid. Before we do, I did want to mention that when it comes to the budget fight, And we all know that this is going to be something that is being dealt with right now. The budget wall is a government program that is worth spending money on. First of all, it's constitutionally recommended. We actually have an obligation by the federal government, Article 4, Section 4, to protect the states from invasion. That is part of the contract between the states and the federal government. And so not securing their border, and if they want to do it without a wall, if they can figure out a way to do it without a wall, I'm all for it, but the wall seems the easiest way to do it. And it's ironic that the Freedom Caucus, who people were saying were not Trump enough, that weren't as harsh on the border as Trump is, are actually the ones that are saying, no, we've always believed this stuff, and we're going to be the ones that fight to build the border wall. And it was people, they just railed on people like me and people in the Freedom Caucus for not just enthusiastically endorsing everything that Trump said and did. And yet, when it comes to agenda, when it comes to policy, they're the ones that are holding the torch. And it infuriates me that we've had a Republican House, Senate, and President for about 2 years now, and we've done virtually nothing with it. We've gotten tax cuts, we've rolled back the regulation state to a degree. And it's not even so much that we rolled it back per se, we just stopped making new regulations. Which, granted, is an improvement, but I don't know that it's necessarily something that we need to hang our hat on. And so we're about to have a Democrat-controlled House coming in, and we'll have nothing to show for it. And if we do not make a stand here and get the border wall funded, there's a very good chance it's never going to get built. And I was afraid that this was going to happen even when Donald Trump got elected, but unfortunately we're seeing this episode play out, and I just don't see this wall getting built. I wish that it would, I hope that it does, and maybe the Freedom Caucus can coalesce the other Republicans around them, but as long as you've got these squishy little Republicans that don't really want to make any waves and don't want to cause any problems, they can't even defund Planned Parenthood, which we already talked about, I just don't see them building a wall. Now, granted, even the $20 or $30 billion that it would take to build the wall that they're talking about, that's a drop in the bucket compared to the federal budget overall. And we would actually probably wind up saving money on the long term because it would prevent more immigration, which is costing us several billion dollars every single year. But nonetheless, I just don't hold out a lot of hope that a lot of the mushy middle Republicans are going to lift a finger to have this border wall built, because the truth is, they don't really care. They're not really all that worried about it. And part of the reason that they're not is because a lot of those moderate Republicans, they're in the pocket of the Chamber of Commerce. And the Chamber of Commerce loves some illegal immigration, because a lot of their big donors, or a lot of their people that belong to the Federal Chamber of Commerce, they are the ones that are employing the illegal immigrants and getting that labor at a cheaper price than they would if they were employing Americans. It's sad, but it's true. Let's go ahead and go to the Daily Dose of Stupid.
Now you messed it up. You're stupid.
Okay, so today's Daily Dose of Stupid, once again, and it's just getting predictable and pathetic at this point. It's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, she has been in the Daily Dose of Stupid probably 6 or 7 times now. We haven't even been doing it that long. But Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she was preparing for a photo shoot, and Politico reported this conversation between her and her photographer. The photographer says, "You can't even run for president for another 6 years." Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, "No, not for a long time, although we've been joking that because the Equal Rights Amendment hasn't been passed yet, the Constitution technically says he cannot run unless he's 35, so what we'll do is we'll force the Republican Party to pass the Equal Rights Amendment by threatening to run for president." Photographer, "That is awesome. All of the people who say a literal interpretation of the Constitution is the only thing you should be paying attention to." Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, "Exactly. All those constitutionalists. I will keep the vigilance." Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez should never mention the Constitution ever again. And the reason I say that is because every time she kind of talks about it, she gets it wrong every single time. She is batting zero. And this is just another example of it. I take you now to, let's see, Article 2, Section 1, Paragraph 5. Okay, here we go. No person, except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution, shall be eligible to the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall have not attained to the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States. Now, did you see the word he anywhere in there? Did you see anything gender-specific in there? No, you did not. And this partially plays to this myth that the founders were a bunch of old white guys that hated women and thought that women shouldn't be able to vote or have any say in politics. First of all, that's patently false, because you look at the amazing influence that Abigail Adams, Martha Washington, and even though Jefferson's wife had already been deceased for a while at this point, she was really an amazing lady, at least by the little bit that I've read about her. Their wives did influence them. They did have an impact on them. And women could still vote. When the Constitution was passed, women could vote. The reason that we needed an amendment for that later is not because it banned women from voting. It was because you had to be a property owner. Women did vote in the 1700s and 1800s. It's just you had to own property, and since the vast majority of women did not, women voting was very few and far between. And I understand even the rationale behind it being property owners, because in their mind, you had to have skin in the game. Because there was no income tax, they taxed your property. And so they were basically coming at it from the mindset of, if you're not paying taxes, you don't get represented. They believed in no taxation without representation, but they also did not believe in representation without taxation. So you don't get to decide how other people are going to spend their tax dollars if you're not putting into the pot. Which actually does make sense, and honestly, I wish that we had a law kind of similar to that. Which is, for the roughly 48% of Americans that are not paying taxes right now, sorry, you don't get to vote. You don't get to tell other people what they do with their taxes. I realize on the onset that seems harsh, and maybe there's even the potential for abuse, but I do not want people that aren't getting taxed themselves having a say in how my taxpayer dollars are getting spent. I don't think that's right. But nonetheless, I won't get too far off on that. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has this weird thing where it's everything she says about the Constitution is incorrect. And so a lot of my conservative brethren are picking on her for being a gaffe machine, and I think that that's correct. I think that that's fair. But calling it a gaffe almost makes it sound like she actually does know the information, she just has a hard time conveying it. Well, considering she says that we need to invent inventions that haven't been invented yet, or that just a couple weeks ago she was saying that we need to take back all three chambers of government, the executive, the House, and the Senate, it just sounds like she really doesn't know the Constitution. And the truth is, I wish it was an isolated incident. And I'm not talking about just with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The reason that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is so interesting is because she's basically a large plurality of the Democrat Party unmasked. She's that Democrat socialist wing of the Democrat Party. Never read the Constitution, don't really care what it says. Because you heard her kind of scoffing at these constitutionalists. Well, the Constitution matters. And a literal interpretation? I don't see how it gets more literal than that. If you had actually read that, you would know what it actually said. It doesn't say he's or he has to be 35. It just says no person that has not attained the age of 35. And so if you're going to quote the Constitution, you really probably should have read it first, and you really need to know what you're talking about. And it's unfathomable to me that any elected official would not know the Constitution, but the truth is, there's a lot of Democrats older than her that don't know what's in the Constitution and really don't care. The reason that they don't come off that way is because they're not dumb enough to open their mouth and prove that they don't know anything about the Constitution. being seasoned politicians themselves. And so, calling it a gaffe implies that she knew the information to begin with. I tend to believe she just didn't know it to begin with. That's what it seems like to me. You can tell by that last half of the conversation that she just does not care about it. And I would like to just give Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and everybody within the sound of my voice a little life advice. And this is life advice that I did not necessarily always follow. And I had to learn the hard way why it's important to follow this idea. Just admit when you don't know something. That is the easiest way to keep yourself out of trouble. And sometimes people do get mistaken. Sometimes people think they have information and they really have it wrong. But if you know you don't know something, if you know that you're not really well versed in this subject or that subject, sometimes it's better just to either not comment on it at all or to just come out and say, look, I'm not really an expert in this stuff. I don't really know a whole lot about it. But at least then you come off as honest. Like in that interview with PBS, when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did that, when she said, I'm not the expert when it comes to foreign relations. I thought it was funny, especially considering that she has a actual bachelor's degree in that subject, and it doesn't make any sense that she's not an expert considering that, but at least it was honest. And I thought that she came off better in that than she is here pretending like she knows the Constitution but really not knowing anything about it. So, if you admit when you don't know something in a discussion with somebody else or when you're talking about a subject matter, it may encourage you to actually go out and learn something about it. And that's why it's important to admit when you don't know something, because that encourages curiosity in yourself. And it opens up the door to be able to learn more. And unfortunately, a lot of her mindless followers in New York City, they also don't know what the Constitution says and don't care. I mean, the photographer that's there with her, he goes along with it and he's like, he says, yeah, that's awesome. All these people that are saying we need a literal interpretation of the Constitution. Yeah, well, if you go by the literal interpretation, or just a straight reading would be the better way to say that, it doesn't say anything about a gender-specific pronoun. Doesn't mention it anywhere. And so, really, you do need to understand that the reason that she got elected and doesn't know this stuff is because the vast majority of people in New York, they don't know the Constitution either, and they really don't care. And that's why she can get away with not knowing it and not caring, because that's where her constituents are. It really is an unfortunate set of events. So I would like to just point out, before we leave this, her plan was to leverage votes by threatening to run for president. Does she really think that that would get her 2/3 of the House and Senate to get a constitutional amendment through? Because I tend to be pretty skeptical of that. I mean, goodness knows I don't want her anywhere near the presidency, but I don't mind if she runs. Heck, if nothing else, it'll be entertaining for me. I mean, if she's getting this much publicity and misspeaking this much when she's not running for president, imagine how entertaining it will be if she actually ever does run for president. Again, it'll be 6 years from now if that's the case, but nonetheless, that would be quite entertaining. So we're going to go ahead and go to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
So Chaplain's Report today, we're continuing in our study on Ruth. And I really have enjoyed this study because I do think that the Book of Ruth just has so much to say about how humans interact with one another, especially in the context of romantic relationships. So just to set the table a little bit for you, this is the point to where Ruth and Boaz have already met. They already seem to have a general admiration for one another. They both tend to like one another, and they sort of see the good in each other. And because of this, Ruth decides she'd kind of like to take it to the next step, and Naomi kind of advises her in this. So Naomi gives her some advice on what she needs to do and how to take care of Boaz while he's threshing, because what's going on now is Boaz has a lot of fields, he has a lot of barley that he's harvesting right now. And just so you know, when the harvest takes place, and this would have been harvest time, when the harvest takes place, what they'll do is they'll take the raw grain into a barn or a facility of some kind, and then they'll thresh the wheat and sort of grind it out to where only the barley, only the edible part, is left. And so they're in some kind of barn-like building when they're doing this, and they work sometimes well into the night trying to get everything done and try to get everything ready to sell it or to store it or whatever else they need just to go ahead and get the wheat ready. And so it would not be uncommon at all for a lot of the workers, in fact all of the workers, to be present and basically be working round the clock to try to get this done not long after the harvest. And that seems to be kind of what's going on here. So we'll go ahead and go to Ruth 3, 6 through 8. And remember, this is the context in which this is all happening. So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came secretly, and uncovered his feet and lay down. What happened in the middle of the night, that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. Now, Ruth is doing this to take care of Boaz. He's very tired, he's already had his meal for the night and drank a little bit, and because of that he's getting tired, and so he goes over next to a pile of grain and sort of just takes a nap. Now, some people might accidentally interpret that to mean something that was going on, that he, you know, just got drunk and sort of passed out at the end of a pile of grain. It doesn't seem to be that that's what's going on. Now, he may be a little bit intoxicated. I can't speak to whether or not he was or not. It says that his heart was made merry. I don't think that that necessarily means that he was, like, falling down drunk or anything, just that he was starting to feel the effects of it. But nonetheless, because of the very labor-intense nature of the work of threshing, like I said, they're working basically round the clock to try to get all this stuff done, which is very unusual in their time, considering they didn't have, you know, electric lights and that kind of thing. So Boaz just goes over and sleeps by this pile of grain instead of heading all the way back to his home. I think that says a lot about Boaz. Boaz is a very wealthy man. That's the way the scripture describes him. And yet, here is Boaz, not in his house, not relaxing while other people and servants are doing the work. He's out there working with them. That's who Boaz is. The man is a provider. He's industrious. He didn't get wealthy by accident. He didn't get wealthy by being lazy. This guy named Boaz, who is actively working to make sure that everything is right in the harvest. He's not leaving the work to other people. He's not isolating them or anything. This is a guy that is concerned about it, and he is willing to put his own hand to the stone, and he is willing to do the work himself. That's the kind of man Boaz is. And I think this is part of the reason that Ruth is probably attracted to him. So he's just a sort of a blue-collar, working-class guy, even though he's very wealthy. And let's take a look. We've looked at Boaz. Let's take a look at Ruth. Why is Ruth doing this? Why is she taking off his shoes, uncovering his feet, making sure he's comfortable, taking care of him when he's gone to go to sleep in this pile of grain, and then staying at his feet? What this says to Boaz, and this is the reason that Naomi advised her to do this, is that I can take care of you. I care about you. I care about your comfort. I care about what happens to you, and I'm going to stay here with you through the night to make sure that you're taken care of. Now, Ruth is doing this at the bidding of Naomi, but she also is willing to do it. She seems to be a very compassionate person. Because here's a wonderful trait in women and men serving one another. And that's not necessarily gender specific, but we serve each other in different ways. And this goes back to this idea of complementarianism, which is really, really important in all relationships. Because men, by our very nature, we need to feel like protectors and providers. And any man that doesn't care about whether or not he's a protector or a provider is probably not a man you want to get involved with. So, as men, we need to feel as though we're guarding things. We need to feel as though people are being taken care of and feel safe and feel like they're adequately fed and clothed and all of these things. We need to feel like we're meeting needs. We need to feel like we are bringing home the bacon, as it were. Which apparently is offensive now, according to PETA, but we're just going to skate right by that. And then you have Ruth, who's a woman, who understands that men need to feel that way. They need to feel respected, and because of that, she and a lot of other women take it upon themselves to try to make sure that their man is well taken care of, that he can recharge a little bit in order to get back out there and be the provider and work hard and all those things. And so that's a important role that Ruth wants to be able to play in his life. And so because of that, and Ruth is not a stranger to work either. Keep in mind, just the last chapter, we saw her being involved in the harvest as well. And so Ruth is not someone that's afraid of work. But she understands that Boaz, he needs a little comfort. He needs a little bit to recharge and sort of set himself back up to go out and work and be productive again. And so because of this, the male and female relationship, they're really kind of modeling how men and women should react to one another. And so because of that, because they care about each other and because they love each other, they are willing to do this for one another. Because men need to feel like protectors and providers, but women need to feel as though they're comforting, they need to feel as though they're needed, and they need to be able to nurture and care for somebody and their well-being in that way. It's just something that God put in them, which is a really good trait that he has. And they do both take care of each other, but in different ways that are best suited to them. So let's take one other look at another verse just a little bit later in Ruth 3, verses 9 through 11. He said, this is Boaz, he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your maid." "So you spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." Then he said, "May you be blessed in the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will go for whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence." So this is really what makes the relationship between Ruth and Boaz so great. They do want to be together, but they want to be together for the right reasons. Because they admire each other. They see virtue in one another. Boaz is looking at Ruth and sees somebody that's willing to take care of her mother-in-law, who she's not even a blood relative of, and willing to become a Jew and follow God and all of these things. And Ruth is looking at Boaz saying, this is a guy who is willing to protect me. He cares for my well-being. He cares about poor people. He wants to help those that are weaker than him. And he wants to be able to provide not just for me, but for other people as well. And so they love each other and they do so for the right reasons. I think sometimes in our society now, we way overcomplicate courtship. We way overcomplicate the male-female relationship, and I don't know if that's all because of romantic comedies or all these other things, but I do know that if you're looking at romantic relationships in the Bible, they're usually pretty simple. And I think that if you're looking back at relationships, at least in my experience, of people that have had successful marriages, their relationships are usually pretty simple. Not perfect. Doesn't mean they never have a disagreement. Doesn't mean that they don't ever get upset with one another or have problems. But they're based off of a really simple concept, which is we've made a commitment to one another, we're going to stay together, and we're going to do so because we love and respect one another. That's really all it boils down to. That doesn't make it easy, but it does make it simple. And I think that's part of the reason that Ruth and Boaz work together, because sometimes when it comes to relationships, we set our expectations way too high. And that doesn't mean that you expect nothing out of your partner. You obviously want to hold them to certain standards and hold them accountable, and that's part of the good thing that comes from being in a relationship. But we tend to think of that everything's going to be all rainbows and butterflies the entire time that we're with them, and I don't know how many times I've heard the phrase, "Well, they make me happy." Well, happiness fades, and they're not going to make you happy forever. So you better figure out something a little deeper than that to be able to hold you together, because if they make me happy is all that you've got, you're going to be unhappy at some point later in your life. And the question is, can your relationship stand up to that? Because if it's built on just Well, I'm happy when I'm with them, ergo, I want to be with them and marry them. Sorry, that's not going to cut it. Because eventually, one or the other, or both of you, are not going to be happy. And as sad as it is to say, that is going to happen, and you've got to figure out whether or not your relationship can withstand that. So, if I had any advice to take away from this, just love other people the way that Ruth and Boaz love one another. That's the best advice I can give. When you're seeking a mate, do so because you're doing it for the right reasons, you respect them, and you want to be with them because they make you a better person. Because they encourage you, and they try to work with you in such a way that you can do more than you could do when you were by yourself. That's the reason that you should be seeking a mate. Because in the end, they help you in your walk with God. Stay the course, friends.